President Trump has renewed a push for a border wall with Mexico and proposed dramatic changes to immigration laws, all in exchange for protecting young undocumented immigrants from being deported. According to Democrats, the 18 policy proposals add up to a non-starter. Geronimo Cortina is an associate professor of political science at the University of Houston. His research interests include American and Latino politics and immigration. Geronimo, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kate, for having me.
First, what do you make of President Trump's list of demands he wants to attach to the DACA legislation?
Well, first of all, once again, it's a change in policy stances. We had a supposed agreement between Democratic leaders in Congress and the president, and the president, to a certain extent, signaled that he was, to a certain extent, once again, positive about, you know, fixing the problem with DACA. But once again, we saw on Sunday that his proposals in terms of trying to resolve a very, very, very important issue that also ranks very high among the American public, he took a step back, and now we have a bunch of demands that could certainly derail having legislation to fix DACA.
Remind us why DACA is so important, how many people it impacts, and what it is.
Well, DACA is a deferred program of for childhood arrival. So these were individuals that were brought to the United States when they were younger than 16 years of age. DACA is a program that allows the executive branch, especially the Department of Homeland Security, to stop and give reply to some of these individuals that have applied to the program, that have no criminal record, that are enrolling in school or have recently graduated, that have served in the military, and that have not committed a crime so far and are employed. So DACA, what it did in 2012 was just giving them, or the executive branch changed their deportation priorities and said, these individuals are productive members of society. We're going to concentrate on deporting other undocumented migrants that need not to be here. So DACA, according to DHS figures, more or less gives reprieve to around 800,000 individuals that have applied to the program. If the program, well, the program has already ended. We saw a couple of weeks ago that Attorney General Sessions resigned the executive order and changed the procedures in Homeland in order to change to stop this reprieve to these individuals. So the problem is that we're going to leave 800,000 individuals without, or once again, in a legal limbo. And they're going to be able or not going to be able to stay here. If their work permits end, they're not going to be able to go back to work. And obviously, the unintended consequences in economic, social terms are going to be devastating.
As you mentioned, about a month ago, President Trump announced that it was illegal for DACA to be enacted through executive order. So he was giving Congress until March to come up with a legislative solution on how to deal with the Dreamers, the 800,000, as you mentioned, Dreamers. Was that executive action by President Obama, was that unconstitutional?
Well, there is a lot of debate, right, about if it was unconstitutional or not. In my opinion, and the research that I have done, I think that the president has the authority to enact such an executive order. And it basically is prosecutorial discretion, and that prosecutorial discretion is under Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, that the president has to take care of the laws to be faithfully executed in the country. So it's a take-care clause, and the take-care clause gives the ability to the president to target some immigration cases for removal and also use this prosecutorial discretion favorably in other cases. That's a legal position, and it goes back until, you know, since 1976. We have this prosecutorial discretion on the books. In 1985, we have it again. We have it in another Supreme Court cases, Arizona versus the United States, in which the Supreme Court said that, the principal feature of our removal system gives broad discretion exercised by immigration officials. And then from a very practical point of view, we certainly have 11 million more or less undocumented migrants here. It is impossible, materially impossible, to simply deport 11 million of undocumented migrants. Why? Because we don't have the resources, we don't have the money to do so, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So from a practical standpoint of view, it would make no sense to do that. It would make sense, as Daka said, and to a certain extent, the deportation priorities of the past administration to deport people that should not be here. Criminals, people that are doing bad into our communities, so on and so forth. And obviously, we have to remember that President Obama administration was one of the contemporary administrations that have deported more individuals than any other administration combined.
We're talking right now with Geronimo Cortina. He is an associate professor of political science at the University of Houston, and his research focus includes American and Latino politics and immigration. Join into the discussion at 800-642-1234. What do you think of President Trump's list of demands in exchange for getting a DACA agreement, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals agreement? How badly do you want a wall along the border with Mexico or an end to so-called sanctuary cities or faster deportations? Join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. You can post your ideas on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Geronimo, right around that time, President Trump had a dinner meeting with House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. A rough outline of a deal was discussed about DACA, which included the president's willingness to take funding for the border wall off the table, which got conservatives pretty upset. He insisted the wall would come later. Now he's calling for it here in these 18 priority list, which in turn has Pelosi and Schumer very disturbed about this. What do you suppose President Trump is trying to do here?
Well, obviously, he's trying to force the hands of the Democratic Party, right, members of Congress. And obviously, it's a negotiating tactic, saying, well, if you really want DACA, you have to give me something in return. And he's using the border wall, at least funding, which in theory was going to be paid by Mexico, but obviously, that's not going to be the case. So obviously, the federal government needs to have a budget allocated in order to build the wall along the southern border. But the question here is if, on the one hand, if Democrats are going to go and try to negotiate this situation in terms of providing or giving funds to build a wall, which so far Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have said, well, this is a non-starter. We're not going to negotiate. And some members of Congress have threatened the federal government to a shutdown if they don't pass DACA first and then focus on the border wall. And then on the other hand, we have the Republican Party, especially those budget hawks that also don't think that allocating money to build a border wall is a good idea for the budget. So we have here the perfect storm, right? On the one hand, you have conservatives that are saying, you know what, we don't have the money. The deficit is going to increase. And then on the other hand, you have Democrats, which their position is not completely united in terms of how to respond to DACA and to the border wall. And then obviously you have pending legislation that needs to be passed before that. We have, you know, several pieces of legislation that have been introduced in Congress. We have Senator Graham's positions. We have Luis Gutierrez's position, piece of legislation, and that needs to be taken, and that needs to be taken to the floor and have a vote and see what happens.
The White House on Sunday demanded, quote, complete construction of a border wall with Mexico and expedited removal of undocumented immigrants. This comes just weeks after President Trump agreed with Democratic leaders in the House and Senate on a simpler bipartisan plan. We're unpacking these latest immigration proposals with Geronimo Cortina. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Houston. His research includes American and Latino politics and immigration. You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. What do you think of President Trump's list of demands in exchange for getting a DACA agreement? Do you see these demands going beyond reasonable border security? Join in at 800-642-1234. If President Trump is going to agree to shield Dreamers from deportation, then the president wants some tougher anti-immigration measures in return from lawmakers. And we learned of these 18 policy proposals on Sunday night that could set the stage for a prolonged fight in Congress. Geronimo Cortina stays with us. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Houston. His research includes American and Latino politics and immigration. You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. What do you think of President Trump's list of demands for the DACA agreement? How badly do you want a wall along the border with Mexico or an end to so-called sanctuary cities? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Geronimo, as you look at these 18 demands, can you pick out some of them that are specifically detrimental to immigration to the United States?
Well, I mean, I think there are two very important demands. The first one is, let me take a step back. The first thing that we have to recognize is that we have the law, immigration law in the country does not work. It is completely outdated. It needs to be revamped 100%. And given the political climate in which we are, political polarization, we need to recognize that we cannot have a comprehensive immigration reform. So the way that we need to tackle this problem, because it is a problem, is we need to take piece by piece and come up with a plan that would allow us to have at the end a comprehensive immigration reform, but taking piece by piece. So that's the first thing that we have to think about it, because once you start with overreaching, given the climate in which we are, legislation is not going to pass. There's no way that it's going to pass, given the current composition of the Senate and the House, the White House, and obviously we are 1 year away from midterm elections. The second thing is, you know, what does it mean to build a wall? How much is that going to cost to us, American taxpayers? So the first thing is building a wall along the border with Mexico is a very, very daunting task. Why? Because the terrain, in some parts of the terrain, are very complicated to build a wall. You would need to build roads to build to transport building materials. You have to pay crews, so on and so forth. The cost so far, we started in the campaign that it was going to cost around $4 billion, and now there are reports that go as high as $70 billion to build a wall. We don't know if the wall, once the wall is built, then you have to maintain it. You have to be able to maintain the wall, 2,000 miles. We already have around 650 miles of fences around the border, primarily in urban areas. But once again, you have to hire personnel to patrol the wall, to maintain the wall, to fix it if there is a problem, if you're going to put cameras to maintain those cameras, et cetera, et cetera. So once we pay for the wall is going to have a annual cost that is going to come out from our pocket. The second issue is that...
And can you speak to the economic impact for everyday Americans and for Wisconsinites as to the burden of the cost of this wall?
Well, I mean, it's going to cost. If it goes to $25 billion or $70 billion, it's going to cost around $200 to each American taxpayer, right? So it's money that we're not going to be spending on the economy because we have to build a wall. And the economic impact of immigration is very complicated. But let me give you an example. For example, dairy farms in Wisconsin, right? Dairy farms rely heavily on migrant labor. What's going to happen if we implement this expedited deportation scheme? Well, there's going to be labor shortages. And those labor shortages are going to impact local economies, not the national economy per se, but local economies. They're going to, farmers are going to lose workers. They're going to try to get, for example, younger hands. But as you know, in Wisconsin, if you look at the northern part of the state, you know, all young people are leaving the state. And those are going to be counties that are simply going to be left, or they are losing young people that could work in dairy farms. Given my experience with college students here in Texas, in my class, with all the students that I interact every single day, there is no single one that wants to become a farmer. So if we don't have people that want to enter the agricultural sector or the dairy farm sector, where are we going to get hands to work our fields? And that's a very, very, very important question. Immigration and economic activity works on the basis of demand and supply. If there is no supply of farm labor, right, internally or domestically, well, farmers have to look for labor outside the United States. People come here and start working on the fields, and that's why we have that. We have had experiments, right, for example, in Georgia a couple of years ago in which a lot of farmers left the state because of anti-immigration laws. That put the state in a very, very, especially farmers, in a very precarious position. The state lost around $140 million lost in crops because they simply didn't have enough labor to pick up the crops. Mm. The state sent prisoners to pick up crops, but the prisoners were not very happy to do that. It's hard labor. You have to be bending your back for 12 hours a day. The pay is not very good. You don't have social security. The living conditions are not excellent. So that creates a lot of problems for the local economy. What would happen? Well, we can raise wages, but we have seen that raising wages is not good business for farmers or for the consumer at the end because someone has to pay those wages at the end, whether it's the producer or the consumer. So if you're buying, I don't know, a gallon of milk for $1, right? Maybe that gallon of milk is going to cost now $1.50. Or maybe the head of lettuce is not going to be worth 75 cents. It's going to be $1.25. So we need to understand that this has unintended consequences that later are going to be introduced into a higher cost for producing, you know, goods and services that we have in our everyday lives.
Geronimo Cortina, I'm sure as a college professor, you have college students who are dreamers who come and confide with you, perhaps talk with you. What do they say to you? What are their concerns?
Well, it's a very, very sad situation. First of all, they are, in my mind, I think they are the perfect migrant, right? These are kids that have been working all their lives. They don't know anything about the countries of origin, their parents' countries of origin. They have lived all their lives in the United States. They have friends here. They have families. They work. They're productive members of society. They pay taxes. They haven't committed any crimes or serious misdemeanors or anything like that. So to know that they're not wanted here, it's a very, very, very demoralizing blow, because they don't know anything else. They don't know anything else. They don't know any other culture. Some of them, they don't even speak, you know, Spanish or whatever other language they speak. They are 100% American. And it's very sad, because it's a very, very emotional topic, because this country was founded by migrants. And that is another very important point on how we discuss migration, right? Because this country is the foundational myth of this country. Immigration, a country founded by migrants, if you work hard, you're going to make it. But then, you know, all these things come. And the other thing is the issue of due process. Should we as a society, put the blame on people that did not make the rational, conscious decision to come to the United States? We cannot do anything about it, because it's already done, and that's done. But what does it say about us as a society? Should we blame them? And they work hard, they study, they pay taxes, they buy houses, they pay mortgages, car payments, send their kids to school, are active in their communities. So why are we not keeping them? And then, on the other hand, from the business perspective, no, is we already invested as a society in these individuals. They went to elementary school. They went to high school. Some of them have served in the military. Some of them have died while serving. They have graduated from college. And now that we can enjoy, right, their fruits of their labor, via paying taxes, via buying a house, et cetera, we're saying, you know what, we don't want you. So we invested all this money, all these resources, and now that they're going to be able to pay back to society as any other person would, we say, no, we don't want to enjoy all your hard work. So from a business perspective, it doesn't make sense.
We're talking right now with Geronimo Cortina. He's a political scientist at the University of Houston, where he researches American and Latino politics and immigration. You can join this discussion, and Geronimo asked the question, should we blame Dreamers? Whose problem is this that these young people are in this country as Dreamers? Is immigration at an impasse? Is this a perfect storm? 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Geronimo, talking about the sanctuary cities, President Trump called for the denial of federal grants to sanctuary cities last month. A federal judge largely blocked the Justice Department's efforts to punish sanctuary cities for a second time this year, saying it would lead to irreparable harm between cities and their immigrant communities. The Trump administration has said sanctuary cities pose a threat to public safety. So what goes on in these so-called sanctuary cities?
Well, first of all, sanctuary cities do not exist. It is a political act that was created by someone. A sanctuary city simply do not exist, because I don't know any city in the United States that would not go and persecute someone because of his or her immigration status. So sanctuary cities imply that if you're a migrant and if you're undocumented, you have a out-of-jail free card. And that simply doesn't happen. It does not exist. If you commit a crime, you're going to be apprehended or you're going to be thrown into the court system and perhaps found guilty or not. So sanctuary cities, first of all, do not exist per se. The second thing that we have to think about sanctuary cities is all police chiefs that have been involved in this situation. For example, here in Houston, our police chief, the fourth largest city in the country, have said and opposed that a sanctuary or anti-sanctuary bill, instead of helping securing our communities, hinders security. Why? Because people are less likely to report crimes. The undocumented population is afraid of reporting a crime And therefore, insecurity or lack of security starts to increase. So that's the first problem. The second problem or the second issue is that we already have, right? We already have all the legal mechanisms for local authorities to collaborate with the Department of Homeland Security to enforce immigration laws. That's a 287G Memorandum of Understanding with the Department of Homeland Security and any police department or state police that would like to do so. And the 287G agreement allows and deputizes local authorities, right, to enact or work as deputized immigration agents. So the mechanisms are already in place, and this should be a local decision that has to be made by county sheriffs or by chiefs of police. And they have to decide if they want to do so. In Houston, we have a shortage of around 1,500 police officers. So if in addition we impose that now they're going to be immigration deputies, we are imposing a cost that is not going to be funded, that is not going to be funded by the state on local taxpayers.
Let's take a Let's take a call now from William in East Troy at 800-642-1234. William, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm a little concerned about your use of the terms migrant and immigrant interchangeably. A migrant worker, whom you correctly state is a very important part of our economy, is generally a person who comes in for a season and then goes back to wherever he came from, he or she came from. Whereas an immigrant is someone who actually makes a move from one place to another on a permanent basis. We're not talking about those who come in illegally. Legally. We're talking about those who come in illegally. So I'm wondering just how much of an impact this would really have when we're talking about migrant workers, not immigrants. However, you correctly point out that the immigrant, the person who comes into the country, if he's forced out because he is considered an illegal, that it would have an impact on our economy because, generally speaking, such people are working for lesser wages than a permanent resident or a citizen. Now, once they become legal, let's say, this DACA thing goes away, why aren't they going to ask for more wages? And wouldn't that put us back in the same economic problem as if they left and we had to pay more wages to people who live here anyway?
Let's get Geronimo to weigh in here on William's questions. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, William. Very, very good questions. So on the first one, yes, there is a distinction between undocumented migrants and migrant workers. I totally agree with you on that one. The problem with migrant workers or the H-2A Temporary Agricultural Workers Program is that it's extremely slow. In order to apply, it could take over a year for a farmer or a dairy producer to get the labor that he or she needs for their business. So that forces, right? That forces and you start a chain reaction. If you have to pick up crops in certain weeks of the year, you need the labor to be there right now at that time so they don't lose the crop. So what happens, if you don't get the labor through H-2A, you're going to rely on undocumented migrants.
And we're going to have to hold that point right there and return to it after this break. We're talking with Geronimo Cortina. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Houston, and he researches American and Latino politics and immigration. You can join this discussion about DACA at 800-642-1234. What do you think about President Trump's hardline immigration demands? Join in at 800-642-1234. Democrats issued a swift rebuke of a new immigration plan submitted to Congress Sunday night. It called for funding the border wall and a crackdown on unaccompanied minors who enter the U.S., mainly from Central America. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democrats are seeking a legislative fix for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program that President Trump ended last month. Geronimo Cortina stays with us. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Houston, where he researches American and Latino politics and immigration. Your call is welcome as well at 800-642-1234. What do you think of President Trump's list of demands in exchange for the DACA agreement? What do you think about a border with Mexico or so-called sanctuary cities or faster deportations? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jim in Kenosha. Go ahead, Jim.
Good morning. I fear a fair plan for immigrants who are in this country, but much tighter restrictions for people coming to this country as immigrants. And I think it says there's security issues, but also we have high unemployment in our urban areas and people who need jobs. And these are Americans, and they have not been fairly treated. We need to, and if our business and industry needs qualified, educated employers, and they can't get them from overseas, even in areas like doctors, engineers, and as well as other, they will force our government to really address seriously our urban problems, as we had tried to address in problems, for instance, in Iraq, with that kind of effort, that kind of money.
All right, Jim, thank you so much. You are fading in and out, so I'm going to let Geronimo respond there. Jim, also addressing urban issues, urban decay, and how immigration could impact jobs.
Well, I mean, there is a lot of debate, but let me just first ask answer William's question and then go to Jim's. I think both of them are very valid questions. The first one, William was talking about, well, what would happen if we grant legal status to Dreamers? Well, here, first of all, Dreamers are already legal as of today. They have worker authorization permits that allows them to work legally in the United States. So they're being paid a wage that is according to the laws of demand and supply of labor. They're paid whatever it's paid to any other American citizen or another worker that has a work permit in the United States. If they become legal, then that should not have any effect on wages because they're already being paid the market wage. So if they get paid higher, that means that the wage market changed, not because they became legal, because they're already legal. So that shouldn't have any significant impact on increasing higher wages on Dreamers. On Jim's point, indeed, our cities, urban cities, are completely decimated. And the question here is, how can we fix this problem? Immigration has to be part of how we fix the problem. Why migrants are taking jobs that some Americans are not simply interested in doing. It is hard labor. It is sometimes very, very physical labor. And yes, the wage market has to increase for everyone, so everyone could have a lot of opportunities. And here, I think the important question is not about the quantity of opportunities that we have as Americans, but it's the quality of opportunities that we have. We have to fix the education system. We have to fix the health system. We have to train our kids in order for them to pick the right and the right career that are going to allow them to live and have a decent life. We have to fix problems about income inequality, health inequality, educational inequality. So all these things, when we put them into the pot, immigration touches every single policy. So it's a very, very complicated issue. Indeed, we have to fix wages. For any American that wants to find a job, he or she needs to find a job that allows him or her to have a decent life. So that is why immigration reform is so, so, so important, because we cannot deny the fact, right, that younger generations don't want to work, for example, in construction. don't want to work on farms at the current wages. If current employers, and we saw this, for example, in Georgia in 2011, Georgia farmers were not able to attract workers, domestic workers, for helping them in the farms. Why? Because, once again, young population are leaving those counties, and these younger generations, they don't want to be farmers. They want to be IT consultants, they want to be bankers, they want to be something else. So how do we fix that? Well, we need a strong worker agricultural program that allows people to come and go as the crops are needed and allow them to go back to the countries of origin to live their lives, come here for a period of time, and then go back. And we have a lot of examples. Canada has a very robust agricultural worker program that is, you know, a contract with workers for many, 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 many years. So workers, when they go back to the country of origin, they know that next year they're going to go back. So
and speaking,
we need to fix these little things one by one.
And speaking to that point of going back to the country of origin, Peter and Madison would like to pick up on that point. Peter, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've heard this notion that you cannot send 11 million people back to the country of their origin many, many times from otherwise educated people. My question is, if 11 million people were able to come here going through deserts, risking their lives, why is it not technically possible, as professor said, for them to go back using legal system of buses, trains, vehicles, especially that they have more money now, whatever that money might be, than when they were coming? So I do not personally see the technical impossibility. Let's quit that argument. And my second quick question to the professor is, following his scenario of those people working in the agriculture of Wisconsin, does he think that their children in 20 years or 25, 30 will be working as milk, producers, and et cetera, or will they go to the cities, will leave the countryside, and leave their old parents who are making $10 an hour with basically no resources to keep going?
Thank you, Peter. I think we got the questions. Go ahead, Geronimo.
Well, I mean, I think it's still impossible to deport 11 million people because not even the government knows where these 11 million people are. The governor knows, for example, exactly where DACA recipients are. Yes, because they apply and they gave out their information and where they live. The rest, we don't know where they are. Simply like that. And the Department of Homeland Security doesn't have enough money, the legal system doesn't have enough money to deport 11 million people. The immigration courts could not handle 11 million deportation hearings at once. If that happened, it would take decades and decades and decades of trying to deport these individuals. Because simply, we cannot simply jump the law and put them on a bus and send them to the southern border or to Canada or whatever. It's impossible. We have a legal procedure that has to be followed. It could be expedited, but again, I don't think that we have the logistical resources nor the money to implement these things.
Let's get
the second question.
If you want to quickly address the second question, but then Morgan in Milwaukee also has a point to make.
Yes, the second question is very interesting. Yes, there's going to be a generational change. And in theory, those kids that are the sons and daughters of migrant workers are going to move up into the socioeconomic ladder, right? However, that is where a strong agricultural worker program kicks in. Why? Because when those farms retire, you still need that labor. And in theory, labor market theory would suggest that those kids that have gone to school, et cetera, are going to improve their lives. And that's going to be also positive to our economy, because instead of living in very precarious situations, they're going to be able to buy a house. They're going to be able to pay more taxes, to buy a car, and that is going to have a multiplier effect on local economies, and that is good for the economy in the long run. But again, you need to have a strong agricultural worker program that would supply the labor that farmers need.
Let's go to Morgan now in Milwaukee. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to introduce a different perspective. Since the DACA issue has been raised in our political system, I feel like so many conversations are revolving around our Latino communities here. And I think, one, that's a great thing because it means that our Latino communities are having voice. But I also think there is a wild misconception in that we only hear about the Latino side of the DACA argument, because the fact of the matter is that the U.S. has immigrants coming from multiple countries in waves. And one of the largest immigration populations that we have in this country is from the Chinese. And the reason why we're not hearing about it is because of the investments that our country has. Our country is in a ton of debt to the Chinese economy. And we're not in a ton of debt to Mexico or some of these smaller countries in Latin America. And so I just wanted to present a larger perspective.
Yeah, Geronimo, can you quickly, we've got like maybe a minute to go here, on Morgan's, what she is saying here.
Yes, absolutely. When I refer to DACA, DACA recipients are from all over the place. However, the most people from DACA, most of them come, obviously, from Mexico and Latin America. But yes, indeed, we cannot deny that a lot of people and also a lot of DACA recipients come from very different countries. We have them from the Middle East, from China and other Asian countries. And this is going to be extremely important, right, to see how these individuals are going to be. We have Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Peru, and Brazil are the top countries that have DACA recipients. And yes, indeed, other countries have important implications. Regarding, yes, this geopolitical situation is very important.
And we have to stop. Yeah, we have to stop you there. I'm sorry. Geronimo Cortina is an associate professor of political science at the University of Houston. This hour was produced by Bill Martins and Keely Baltina with technical direction from executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.